This was the first time in my life where I would tell my Japanese colleagues or anyone else that, hey, I'm French. And then they would say like, oh, bonjour, or like, oh, I like wine, I like cheese, I like bread, and not like ask me, oh, yeah, but like, you don't look French. Where are you from? What's your roots? What's your background? And as crazy as it is, because, you know, people have this image of Japan being like super racist, but this is the place where I actually felt the less discriminated against and felt the less racism in my whole life.
Hello and welcome back to Third Culture Conversations. And if you're a first-time listener, then welcome to the show where I bring you both entertaining and thought-provoking stories as well as insights from the great people that I've had the fortune to get to know. Some of them for years and others for as little as only a few weeks. But given that you found your way to this podcast, I'm sure you'll agree that the quality of the time spent with someone can make it feel like you've known them for far longer than you have. And today's guest is a prime example. I got to know Sadie last year through some mutual friends when I was invited to join a monthly mastermind group with them. Without it sounding too regimented, we use this monthly catch-up as an opportunity to keep in touch, talk about what we've been up to, and also get the rest of the group's opinions and advice on the goals that we've set ourselves. And given his background and how quickly that I connected with him, it was a no-brainer to have Sadie on as a guest on this show. As a French Algerian, Sadi's story of his upbringing fascinates me, and you'll soon see why. In this conversation, we discuss what it was like to move from a neighborhood full of other third culture kids and children of immigrants to one dominated by white families, and how he dealt with appearing not quite the same as the rest of the kids. I got to explore his first-hand experiences of Africans in France during a time when racial propaganda was, and still is, very much in the public eye. We also cover his move to Japan and how it was to integrate into the social and professional scene there, as well as what is next on his agenda. I've had a few of you ask me recently what my end goal is for the podcast and why I commit to doing this every week. So stick around until the end and I'll share a bit more on this. But as always, it's a pleasure to have you here with me. So I hope that you are ready for episode 7 of Third Culture Conversations. We are live. Sadi, welcome to the Journey Onwards podcast. What a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, man. It's nice to be here.
I was thinking, what's amazing is we've never even met, but we've got to know each other quite well. And we've never met face to face, but here we are doing a podcast session.
No, that's great. I mean, hey, that's, you know, the power of like, you know, having friends from all over the world and like, you know, always willing to connect to, you know, other good people as well. So that's why I'm really glad that, you know, you thought of me for this podcast, and I'm happy to dive in, you know. But definitely we need to meet, you know, next time, you know, when I come to London, hopefully soon, and we'll be able to meet for real as well.
Well, yeah, this is awesome because there's so much to cover, so I'm hoping we can do it in a sensible amount of time. But there's your history, your family history, and then your journey.
Sure.
I have no worry about this podcast. This is going to go well. But what if when we meet, it doesn't live up to this hype of how we've got to know each other? That's my fear.
Yeah, that's true. But hey, but the good thing is that, you know, we'll know a lot about each other and stuff. And for me, it was really like, you know, when we talked about this thing, and that from the very beginning, when you had this idea of doing things, and, you know, with like, you know, the guys, when we were doing calls, like, hey, you should definitely do it. That's a super interesting subject. And so far I've been listening to like, you know, most of the podcasts you've done, and it's been holding up to what it was, you know, supposed to be. So I'm really glad that, you know, I'm part of it as well now.
No, for sure. Yeah. So let's dive in.
Sure.
Because I'm sure people listening are like, okay, these guys are just talking away. So what I like to do is keep it open to you to lead the way. And okay. So let's start with going back to your beginning roots.
Yep.
The environment you grew up in and how that has been shaped by your parents' journey.
Sure. So I was born and raised in France. Have an older sister as well. She's born here as well. My parents come from Algeria, so they immigrated back. My dad back in the 60s, late 60s, and my mom in the 80s here in France. And we basically, you know, as you call it, second generation here in France. We call it first generation to be born in France. So I'm definitely, you know, part of this group that you call like the third culture kid, right? So we basically grew up, you know, in an environment that was very close to our roots in Algeria, because mainly due to the fact that, you know, we have a lot of family here in France that come from Algeria, but we also have a lot of family in Algeria as well. And I think that's also, you know, shown by the fact that maybe until high school, until I was like whatever, 16, 17, we used to go every summer back to Algeria to spend some time with the family there, you know, some grandparents being there and some, you know, aunties and uncles being there as well, cousins. So we would always kind of have this kind of like link to the countries of our parents and to our own country as well by, you know, going there for whatever, sometimes a month, sometimes 2 months in summer, the whole, you know, summer vacation being in Algeria. So that would be kind of like ingrained into our like, okay, habits to know about like, you know, both cultures, right? Now it's a thing as well that also played for us in France, because you would be growing up and living in some neighborhoods where diversity will be here in terms of like, you know, having people coming from all walks of life, from any kind of like countries of Africa or even Asia as well. And they would have the same kind of background, or you would have your, you know, regular, you know, French friends that would only, you know, live here in France as well. So the thing is in France that when you're a kid, and especially during education, you don't really see kind of like, you know, color or whatever, or like, you know, background, whatever. We're just like a bunch of kids together here. And then it's just that, you know, depending on where you live, you'd have more diversity than, you know, than in other neighborhoods. But where my sister and I grew up until we were like maybe 12, until I was 12 years old, it was a very kind of like popular neighborhood where I'd say it's kind of like the hood, you know, of, you know, Paris. It's like in the suburb, and you would see a lot of the people here would be, you know, sons of immigrants, you know, children of immigrants, and most of it would be, you know, African immigration. So a lot of North Africans and sub-Saharan Africans as well. So most of your classroom would be like, you know, very, you know, colored basically. And you would have a few white people and stuff like that. But then through the years, it's obviously, you know, even less and less. And then, so it was like, you know, until I was in like junior high. And then my parents, you know, my dad got a chance to have like kind of a better outcome with his work. And we could actually move to another place, another suburb of Paris as well, which was a lot more, let's say, middle class, instead of like being, you know, a very poor area. It was a lot more a middle class kind of area. And there, that was a bit weird, because then, you know, I would be maybe one of the only two kids that was like, you know, not white. So then that was for me, you know, growing up in like in this place, which was more of the hood, where, you know, everybody was like, you know, black or Arab or whatever, with the same kind of background, coming to a new place now when I'm a teen. And then, you know, everyone around me is white, and they all see me like, okay, who's that guy, you know, coming from the hood or whatever, right? And then, you know, it was fine, because still, you're still young and you still kind of adapt to that, and it's okay. You just think like, fuck, okay, people here think differently, act differently, I'm just going to have to adapt, right?
So that's interesting. One of the things you mentioned, which is quite funny, is that you said, you know, when you're younger and you don't really see color. And I know the French, I don't want to say the French as a whole, but they've been through this phase of trying to claim that they are blind to color, which, I mean, we'll get into it, but that's obviously, you know, saying one thing and acting another way. This will be very interesting.
Of course.
But so you moving to that kind of neighborhood, this is a question that I love to ask third culture kids. So when you are asked by either, you know, the new kids or the kids from there, you being the new kid on the block, or even when you go away to a new place and someone says, so where are you from? You know, so what is your background?
Yeah.
What kind of response did you give back then?
So, I mean, at the end of the day, again, right, I think I see where you're coming from with your question here. I think, you know, as long as I was a kid, you know, up until maybe, you know, university, then people would say, okay, where are you from? You say, okay, I was born there. My parents are from Algeria, but that's pretty much normal here. Because in France, it's, especially when you're a kid, you don't really realize the weight of this question. You just say, hey, I'm Algerian. Hey, I'm Moroccan. Hey, you know, I'm whatever, right? So you just really don't care. And that's normal to say that, right? It's just for me down the line when I was growing up and, you know, getting to know a little bit more about the world, having a political conscience and stuff like that, then you're like, okay, well, now I'm getting old, you know, I'm a student or even work, and then I meet someone new and they just ask me about, you know, where I'm from, and I'm saying, hey, I'm from this city, you know, in the suburb of like Paris. And they're like, yeah, but where are you from? You know, and I'm like, Well, yeah, I'm from France. And like, no, but your background. Oh, yeah, I'm from Algeria. Oh, Algeria. And especially French, you know, when you say you're from Algeria, your parents are from Algeria, then it has even more weight than any kind of other countries because of like the war that happened and stuff like that. But when you're a kid, you just don't really realize that. The only thing that happened was more, okay, now I'm in a new city and most of the people, you know, here are white and they have, you know, obviously more money and stuff like that. So you get to do different kind of things. You have different kind of friends as well. And I was at an age still that I like, okay, fuck, that's a bit different. And now some of the people, they don't like, I don't fit in well in terms of like, you know, connecting with them or whatever. Of course, you're really adaptable, so you get through it. But then looking back, you're like, okay, then there was a bit of a difference then, you know, from before.
And so with your home environment, so like you say, where you initially grew up and there were people around you that were various colors, children of immigrants. But when you moved to the new neighborhood, in terms of your home environment, say if you were hanging around with your white friends, did you notice a stark difference in their upbringing, the way their parents would reflect values onto them versus what you had? And did that make it difficult to connect with them in a way?
Yeah, so I think that's definitely on point, right? Because, you know, where I was before, it was more like, you know, everybody kind of the same background, having parents coming from Africa. So, and it's the same as, you know, I think you as well, with your background, you know, people coming from either Africa or India, or even China or Asia, people are really a community and everything is about solidarity. And when you go home, you're going to have a meal. When you have your friends coming over, your mom's going to cook for everyone. It's going to be like a big feast, right? And everybody is welcome to come and stay as much as they want. I'll tell you this anecdote, which is really funny. One of my friends, you saw a white kid, right? I get invited to his house to do, you know, some homework, right? And then we come to his house and it was like, I don't know, maybe 4 o'clock or something. And usually in French, you know, when you're a kid at this age, then you have this time of the day, which is called goûter, which is kind of like tea time kind of thing. And you get, you know, some tea or whatever, some juice, some biscuits. And what happens is that he goes and he gets some milk and some biscuits and he starts eating in front of me. He doesn't even tell me like, hey, do you want some? Or like, let's share. He was just eating that. And then the crazy thing is like, okay, well, this is education here. We've not been raised the same way. But the thing is, his mom was in the house and she saw what was happening. And she was like, oh, are you guys okay? And then I was seeing this guy. He was like fucking drinking his glass of milk with the biscuits. And I was like, okay. And for me, it was kind of a little culture shock here because that would never happen in my house, right?
Yeah.
So these kind of things are like, I mean, as you might have seen as well, you know, for me, the most shocking part was really the talking back to your parents. Like, you know, I would go, you know, for lunch at some friend's place and then they were like, oh, this is disgusting. What did you do? Like, what the fuck is that? Like, I can't eat that shit. And I'm like, whoa, if I would say that to my mom, I would be smacked in the face right away.
100%.
I guess, you know, that's the kind of thing that you kind of discover when you switch environment, right?
It is insane. It's exactly that. And even in the conversation with Vic, which was episode 1, we talk about how just the way that we are raised, that hospitality element of having anyone over, even if it's someone that's not a close friend, a really close friend, it doesn't matter, that comes first. It's almost to the point of you overfeed them.
True.
Right? It's the prime thing. If your friend came in or someone came in and you didn't offer them at least water, if not more, then you're reflecting badly on the whole family's values, not just your own. You're not just a selfish or ignorant person yourself, but it says something about the family and environment you're raised in.
Yeah.
And so quickly going back to your upbringing, how would you describe it in brief in terms of what was your home environment like?
Okay. So, I mean, my home environment, I'd say would be a little bit different from, I'm not going to generalize obviously, right? But like was a little bit different from the kind of like other environment of people with the same background as I am. As in, in a way, my dad was kind of working in an industry that was not the same as most of the other immigrants with his background. So, you know, most of the people, I mean, as you might know, which might be the same in the UK, but like in France, really what happened is that after the World War II, they had to go, okay, let's go and dig in the colonies. Let's bring like, you know, some cheap labor and build, you know, build back France. And, you know, obviously French people wouldn't want to do this job. So let's bring some people. So they would actually have people coming from Europe as well, Portugal, Italy, the first immigrants were them. And then later down the line, people coming from North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa as well. And most of these people, they would work in a few industries that would be most of basically building industry, civil works and stuff like that. And then manufacturers, so heavy industries or car manufacturers and stuff like that, they were working those kind of like super, you know, hard labor.
For very low pay, right?
Exactly. And then so my dad, fortunately, so he came from Algeria when he was, I think, 12. And he came to France to be with his dad, who was, you know, my granddad, who was like actually in France for a while to work in this kind of industry, in like, you know, car manufacturing. And then he actually was able to bring his like sons to France for to live there. And my dad and my uncle, they didn't speak French at the time, but they had to go to school and like just learn with all the kids and stuff like that. And from there, he was kind of lucky enough to not go and to the usual route of like learning how to repair a car or like, you know, build something. And he went through another route, which was more the kind of like graphic industry.
Okay.
At the time, obviously, you know, there was no computer or anything, so everything was done by hand, right? But then he kind of like learned this industry, like, you know, how you make like a magazine cover or stuff like that. And then he found a job in that field, in a very small company. And at some point, he was able to kind of like, you know, be the owner of the company. So he had like his own like small company doing like graphic design and working for magazines and stuff. So then in that environment here, that kind of allowed him to hang out with different communities, because obviously this was not like the building industry or the manufacturing industry. So he was not part of like, you know, staying in the same kind of group with only people from Algeria or like, you know, North Africa or whatever. He was in an environment which was more mixed, and he was like obviously more with like working with white people. And in that sense, I think this kind of reflected into the education of my sister and I, which was more, okay, let's focus on like school first, you know, education is the most important thing. And then obviously also learn French, right? So, for example, for me, you know, my parents, they speak Berber, which is like a small dialect in Algeria. I do as well, you know, understand, my sister as well understand, but we don't like, I don't speak it like fluently, right? I'm not like super fluent in that. Whereas I would see, you know, some of my cousins, some other friends, they would really be speaking that language like perfectly like French, because they would be in an environment where it was more like, okay, back like big in Algeria. Whereas my parents, they tried to kind of like say, okay, you're in France now, you got to make it here. So let's make sure that, you know, you got to learn French first and you got to learn these things first, like perfectly, before we put like a lot more emphasis on like learning your own, like, you know, language or whatever, right?
And so your family or even people that you knew that were still a lot more connected to the Algerian roots was part of the reason for holding on to that, because of that pride of being Algerian. And now I'm going back to, you know, obviously in the 50s where there was the revolution of Algeria, Algerian freedom.
Yeah.
Are they still very much like, we are Algerian and we want to hold on to these roots, even though that sort of French influence is heavily infiltrating it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that definitely is a point here. And obviously, you know, in general, Algerian people are very proud because of, especially because of what happened, because there was a war, because they took back in their independence and stuff like that. And that did play a lot. And that did play a lot in the fact that, you know, people were like kind of like still hanging out with each other. But I would say that I think it's more the kind of like community effect, right? The more you stay in your close community and the less you open, and the more you kind of like stay in that kind of like background and you don't like when you reach out. So I'm not saying it's bad or it's good, but it's more like this didn't kind of happen on our side. And then that's also why, you know, since, you know, he was able to kind of like get his own company, then we could move to kind of a better neighborhood and obviously going to better schools as well, getting a better education. And that played a lot in, you know, my sisters and my future and being able to go to the best schools and, you know, also being able to have like somehow great jobs as well. But then most of the people, they usually get stuck in those, you know, bad neighborhoods and social housing, and they're still there right now. And like, you know, I have a lot of cousins there, a lot of friends there, and like the kind of like ratio of people that really make it is very, very low, right? And still we even see it like right now in the pandemic as well. They are also the community that are like, you know, really badly hit, and the one that, you know, don't believe in vaccines and stuff like that, and that kind of stay in that kind of like, you know, like situation, right? So the luck, I think, in that sense is that, you know, luckily my dad went into another industry that could like get him to like, you know, be an entrepreneur and like, you know, do something else. where I see, you know, my cousins or my uncles, they work in the same kind of industry. And for them, it was a lot harder to get their kids, or even their kids now that are like younger, to get to go and go do higher education and stuff. Because I would say the difference also between, you know, African immigrants and I'd say Asian immigrants is that the emphasis on, you know, studies is not the same. So for me, I was more like lucky that, you know, for my dad and mom, it was like the most important thing, a little bit like you guys. But then usually, like, when you see a lot of people coming from these backgrounds, the parents would be like so fucking tired or so preoccupied about, you know, about what's happening, you know, trying to make, you know, ends meet and stuff like that. And they would not have any idea of how the education system works in France, that they would not know what's the best for their kids, right? So that's why also now it's still the same thing, unfortunately, but hopefully it's changing a little bit because people are getting more and more into French society and know how you could like kind of like succeed here, basically.
You mentioned something interesting about how the Africans or North Africans still have this kind of lack of belief or this anti-vaccine movement. And I know one of the things that at the time when COVID was kicking off and they were trying to find vaccines, I can't remember who said it, but they said, let's test it on the North Africans.
Yeah,
because for
in Africa.
Yeah, for such a long time now, it's been kind of heavily preached that the Africans are a lower form of humans or in society, right? So it's kind of, they're almost getting tested as the guinea pigs.
Yeah.
I guess question one is, do you think that's partly plays into why Africans have this kind of reluctance to the vaccine? But then secondly, have you noticed in your kind of direct experiences where Algerians and Africans have been genuinely quite openly viewed as a lesser form of human in society?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, to go to the point of the vaccine thing, obviously, you know, there was a big scandal because this happened in the past already. Yeah. This happened in the past where France or Europe or whatever, they would go in Africa and test the vaccines there because obviously, you know, you have people with disease over there and you need to kind of like treat it. So they come up with vaccines, but obviously there's no, those kind of diseases are not like, you know, in Europe or anywhere else. So you need to find the people to actually do it. So I think in a way you have to do the trials, you have to do this. It's a good thing. But the problem that happened here is that apparently, and I'm sure this happened, is that people would know that they would go on a trial for vaccines. They would go and get their shot thinking that we're going to, you know, they get cured, but they didn't know that it was part of a trial. So you would have people coming in and get a shot without knowing that they could die from it or whatever. So that's kind of like the shady part here. And that's also why when COVID happened, like people would say, oh, let's what, like we did bad day in there. Let's just go to Africa and test them over there and like test the vaccine on them. Like they're fucking guinea pigs, right? Mm. That's a part of society that's still here. Obviously, you know, it's kind of fading away a little bit. And to your second point as to, you know, are like, you know, Africans, you know, lower kind of human beings. That's definitely the case. And I think it stems from colonization for sure. And I think as opposed to the UK and British, where it's going to be more so, even if they think that it's the case, they wouldn't like say it blatantly. Here in France, they would talk like really openly about that. And they would really like put that in your face and put you back in your place or in your case that you are a African or you are a North African or whatever, or you are a Muslim and, you know, you're like a lesser human. And that's like that's more kind of like the feeling that I have here, and I, you know, I've been, you know, subject to that, you know, in my whole life, and some as well, and you know, we can dig deeper in that thing later, but that's something that's definitely happening, and it's like it's still going on right now.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think this is what was really fascinating for me. So there's a couple of things I want to touch on. This article, for me, it's so I think it's called La Aurore. I'm probably butchering that completely. But in the 50s, so this is a while back. But in that French periodical, it says, in Paris, North Africans are specialists and record makers in nocturnal attack. The Arab is quite precisely the thief who waits on the corner of the road for the late passerby, whom he clubs for the sake of a watch, right? And it's
yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
You know, in the UK, you have this. Are police slightly biased towards picking on a gang of black people versus white people? Obviously, there's the whole Black Lives Matter. So it's not like this thing is solely in France and that's what's happening and everyone's pointing fingers. This thing is happening everywhere. But like you say, it's kind of, this is very apparent and blatant. And just another example where the propaganda wasn't just there. You know, it's happened in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Like in the 60s, it was in a public health institution which was saying that it specifically was telling French people that because Africans come from a hot country where they don't wear as many layers of clothes, and now they're coming to our country and they're bringing with them a lot of diseases like tuberculosis. So it's even the health journals are saying this kind of thing.
Of course, yeah.
So the fact that it's carried on through, and then even the National Front, and I'd love for you to tell me a bit more about that as well.
Yeah.
Do you see that even kids at a more younger age are being filled with this kind of media as it becomes even more publicized? Or do you see people now looking at it and being like, wow, that is so right wing. There's got to be something, you know, are they just more open to how blatant this kind of discrimination is?
Yeah, so honestly, I think, you know, I'm going to have a bit of a pessimistic view on that one, because when I left, it was the case. And I thought, okay, if I come back in 10 years, you know, things are going in the right way, so it's going to be better. But unfortunately, it's gone even worse. And now there's been a poll recently because, you know, everybody thought, okay, you know, the war in Algeria was still in the 60s, so it's not that far from now in terms of, like, you know, human history. And there's still those people that actually went there and tortured people. They're still there. Like, you know, Front National, Le Pen, you know, Marine Le Pen, his dad, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was the founder of this, like, National Front party. He was a fucking executioner in Africa, right, in Algeria. And he went, he tortured people, he killed people. He actually lost his right eye, you know, in the war over there, right? And this guy is still here, he's still alive. So the thought was like, okay, these guys, like, fucking racist, whatever, nationalist people, they're gonna die, you know? We're gonna be at a point, you know, in life where all those people from, like, the war from Algeria and stuff, like, they're gonna die, and people are gonna be more progressive, more open, because now we live in a multicultural society. There's a lot of diversity. We're winning the World Cup in 1998 and in 2018, and, you know, it's all of that good thing. So that's on paper, that should be the way. But now what's happening is that they've been very, very good at shifting their the way they do their propaganda. Before, when it was, like, more kind of in your face, now this part is more like, okay, we're going to have some journalists, some philosophers, some whatever, being the guys that are, like, really right-wing and spread all kind of word around. But for us, we'll be a little bit more mild. We'll be a little bit more tolerant so that we can actually attract a bigger, you know, a bigger population to vote for us. And now when I saw this poll, I think it was a regional election, like, a few months back. Oh, yeah, that's going to happen now, actually. But the poll was saying that actually within the age range of, like, you know, 15 to 25 years old, then about, like, 35% people would want to vote for National Front. And to me, that was like, whoa, that was mind blowing, because I'm like, fuck, those are the younger generation which are born in this kind of, like, you know, new world, which also have friends, you know, from all walks of life, which, like, listen to rap music. And now the culture as well, you know, is very influenced by, you know, sons of immigrants, whether, you know, in sports or in, like, music or in anything else. Like, even, yeah, I think it was 2 days ago, the master chef kind of thing, which here is a big deal in France because, you know, French cuisine and whatever, right? With, like, the big 3-star chef. The guy that won is actually, his name is, like, Mohammed. He's, like, French Algerian. So this kind of thing is kind of happening right now. But then on the flip side, you see the younger generation, they still want to vote, like, on the far right. And I think it's partly to blame to, you know, media, obviously, being, like, super strong. People still watch TV here. But most of it is social media. And now what happened is that this National Front, they took over, you know, social media like crazy. And they have, like, those small. And I mean, at the end of the day, this is exactly what's happening in the US as well. This is exactly what's happening in the UK at some point as well. It's more like social media took such a huge, you know, part of our life right now that people don't go and read, you know, The Guardian or whatever, or like watch the real news. They watch their news on social media, on Instagram, on Facebook, on YouTube. And for them, since there's so much information and everything is so fast, that they think that everything is real and everything is facts. That's also why all those conspiracy about vaccine stuff, like, you know, spread super fast, right? And same thing with racist ideas, they spread super fast because people are fucking, you know, glued to their phones. and they just like listen to what's happening. They get brainwashed into that, and boom, you get Trump. Boom, you get Brexit. So I don't know, man. That's a bit like, we'll see what happens in the next few years. But in the meantime, you know, UK or the US, although there's the same kind of racism, people are still like, you know, suffering from that. Here, I'd say it's like the layer is even like, you know, more in your face. And even in terms of like systemic racism, it's even worse, because you would not see any kind of like black people or Arabs or whatever leading big companies in France, you know, that are listed or whatever, right? You would see that in the US, you would see that in the UK. You would never see that here. Now, on the political stand, it's changing a little bit, especially with, you know, the guys like Macron or like the left side, which are like now more integrating people from different backgrounds. But even honestly, less than 5-10 years ago, you would see like the far left, the center right, and the far right, everything would be like just plainly white. You would look at the fucking parliament of France, it would be like plainly white. Nobody is represented, as you know, on any elected capacity. So now the political policy is changing a little bit, but there's still like a big lag compared to the US or the UK or any other developed country, I would say.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, because with the National Front, I know one thing with their campaign, it was like 2 million migrants, 2 million unemployed.
Yeah.
And I think there was the quote which was like, yes, I believe in racial inequality. And one of the things they did was ban any black people from appearing on front covers of publications and magazines. So it's like, to hear this stuff, like, no, black people cannot be in the front cover of a magazine. So scrap those. Those are completely banned. But I mean, we could talk for hours about this. It's so fascinating. And I'm sure we will. And, you know, if there's demand for people who just want to hear about the history of Algeria and France, then bam, we'll do another episode.
Sure, fine.
Actually, one thing I wanted to mention, which is a recommendation, but there's a documentary called A Creepy Line. I don't know if you've heard of it, but
No. It
starts off with kind of the history of Google and how it initially wanted to become like the global library, but then it very quickly, they were like, yeah, we want to become the sort of knowledge of everything. But the creepy line bit is how it's not just an algorithmic search engine where, you know, you type in and the optimal result comes out on the cover. That's what it is. The whole creepiness is apparently there is a layer underneath, which is that there is very targeted, you know, depending on what you type in and where you are, they can control your decisions, which is fine because there's targeted marketing, until it's a point where people might be typing in, who should I vote for?
Yeah.
What party should I listen to? Then it becomes a case of whoever in the back end is controlling how that message gets delivered.
Exactly.
There's another stat, which is, I think, over 80%, maybe even close to 90% of people do not go past page one of Google. Right. And so it's you just true. Take what you see. You see a ranking order, and the way our minds are programmed, we see something in a ranking order. We put the thing at the top is the most important. So we just take the first few links without any consideration of why that those are the most correct and the most relevant. So that's just something if you want to look into, where, you know, like you're saying about how kids' minds are kind of going one way or the other. It makes you think differently about Google. I still use Google, but side thought.
I mean, that's a whole other debate, but like, yeah, there's going to be some need of regulation for those big guys, because they're having like so much influence in our lives that we just lost control, right? And it, as you say, this is a creepy line. It crept in on us like slowly, and now we just live with it and we don't even realize that it's doing that.
Yeah, it's insane. Let's go back to you.
Let's go back.
And so you went and studied civil engineering.
Yeah.
And I was at one point going to do civil engineering.
Okay.
Yeah, I find it super fascinating. So what made you come to that decision of taking the route of civil engineering?
Yeah, okay. So I'll try to give you like a quick background of how things work in France as well in terms of education. But basically, so being in that good neighborhood, I was going to a good high school, and most of the people in this high school usually go in very intensive preparatory course to do a kind of national exam to go in what friends call grandes écoles, which is a little bit of a different system that you would see anywhere in the world, where you just go to uni. And for example, you know, you have the Ivy League in the US, or you have, you know, Oxford, Cambridge in the UK. In France, we don't have those big universities. We have what we call grandes écoles, either engineering or business. And it's a small pool of people every year. They just like hire whatever 100 people or something like that. They recruit 100 people. But then that means that if you go on the best ranked kind of like grandes écoles, the top three, then you are the kind of like the elite of France, basically. And at the end of the day, we also have a lot of universities, but they just don't carry that weight. And they just carry most of the people, which is like 90% of like, you know, French students. But then they don't get to go and get the best jobs or the best like future. You have to go through that route of like grandes écoles if you want to get like, if you want to hit the best, you know, jobs and opportunities in life. And I was lucky enough to not go in university, not because I didn't want to, because I knew that like, you know, if I go to university, I'm not going to be motivated or whatever. So I wanted to go and do an engineering school because I was studying engineering. It was really nice when I was in high school. But then I kind of got turned down by a few schools, and partly because I wasn't that like, you know, white dominated high school, and the teachers, let's say, didn't like me that much because I was not part of the normal pool of people. And then, you know, you have to actually somehow sometimes get like some kind of a recommendation of like, you know, a teacher, okay, I recommend that student enough. And so, and some of these teachers really didn't like me, and they just didn't recommend me for me to go in those like, you know, schools. And I was like so pissed, and I was like, fuck, what do I do now? So I just went and, you know, talked to some counselor, what should I do, blah, blah, blah. And then I just like subscribe and go into those like super intensive preparatory course to be able to get to the best school without knowing what it was. And then I got admitted to a very shitty one in a really bad neighborhood, not far from where I am. But then it was kind of one of the best experiences because it's just like you go and you just learn mathematics, physics, English, and then French. And that's it. It's four subjects, but like very intense, like 9 to 6 every day. And then you have every weekend, you have like a 5-hour big exam to prepare you for the fucking final examination. And you do that for 2 years. And actually in math or whatever, you get to a certain level of like almost PhD level. It's super, super intense. And at the end of the day, you do the exam, and then based on your grade and your ranking, then you can get to the best school, you know, coming from the top, right? And so that's what for me, when I did that, you know, after studying like 3 years, this like super hardcore preparatory course, I was not the best when I was in high school, but then doing that, it kind of like helped, you know, my brain, you know, develop and like, you know, learn faster and everything. And the best school that I could get was actually this like civil engineering school. It's called civil engineering, so we study civil engineering, but we study like a lot of other things as well, business and all other like engineering related matters. So you can basically do whatever you want after that, but mine was more catered for civil engineering or building engineering. So most of the people would go and work for, you know, big construction companies or real estate developers or stuff like that, right? And for me, when I was there, I really, you know, enjoyed that. But then I thought, okay, actually, I'm not really interested into going into a building site and like, you know, taking this kind of like job. I was more interested in the business side into real estate. So then I went back and then did another kind of MBA in a business school to kind of learn more about finance and real estate. This one in another Grande École, which is like one of the top business school as well. And then from there, this is where I just wanted to kind of like go and work, start my career in real estate.
And so once you finished that, did you work in France for a bit?
So what happened is that when I was in my engineering school, I was lucky to travel abroad. I actually did an internship in Saudi Arabia.
Amazing.
So at the beginning, I thought, okay, shit, I want to go, you know, in one of those Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, Dubai or Qatar, because you can, as you're young, you can get paid super well and living in a compound or whatever and just racking some money and then paying not much taxes. And then, you know, you just come back whenever. But then when I went there, I hated it so much. I was like, nah, this is not for me. So I came back and then had the opportunity to actually go and do an exchange program in Japan in a Japanese university in 2010, back in 2010. I was like, you know what? Like, screw it, let's do it, right? I mean, yeah. I always had some kind of interest in Japan and had the opportunity to go there. And I was like, okay, let's just try, right? And I went there for 6 months and I started learning Japanese and stuff there. And I really fell in love with the country. And for me, I was, you know, born and raised in France, spent most of my time in France, going to Algeria, but I didn't travel much back then in my life. I didn't travel anywhere else. I went one time in Saudi Arabia, I hated it. And then went to Japan and boom, you know, I mean, you've been to Japan, right? And when you go there as a kid with not much travel experience, you're like, what the hell is going on here, right? So then I spent 6 months here and then I came back to France to graduate from my engineering school. And I was like, screw this. Like, you know, it was right in 2010, 2011. And it was right at the middle of the European debt crisis. So I was like, fuck, I'm not going to be able to find a job. So then I piled in again to do like a MBA, and so that I could actually maybe go and find a job in Japan after that. And to finance my MBA, I actually worked for like 6 months in France, you know, in real estate developer. And same thing, I fucking hated it. And even before, you know, when I was looking for internship back when my engineering school, you usually go to those like big network fairs. And then you go there, you know, with your name, where you born, you have to say, you know, where you're born on your CV and shit like that. And and then you try and get an internship. And then as soon as you go and talk to them, they're like, yeah, now we're not hiring. I'm like, bro, this is a networking fair. Everybody's getting internships here. And then you see your, you know, friend that's like, you know, that's his name is Mark or whatever, like a French name. And then boom, they just get this internship right away. And then for me, that was really the big start of like,
crazy
shit, I don't think I'll be able to start, you know, working in France. And especially, you know, I worked my ass off to go in the best schools. And now, even if I did that, I somehow managed to get away from this whole thing, then I still, you know, struggle to find a job. I mean, screw this, right? If I can have an opportunity outside of there, then let's do it. And then from there, you know, when I did my MBA and stuff, I was like, okay, let's look for a job in Japan. And then this is just like, you know, second layer of immigration, right? So my parents immigrated from Malaysia to come to France for kind of a better life or whatever. And then for me, I'm like, okay, then I'm just going to leave France and try and make it somewhere else to also have a better life in somewhere, right? And this is where, you know, I managed to kind of get an internship there and then started to kind of work in Japan.
That's amazing. And do you think because your parents had been through that experience of their own, do you think either directly or subconsciously it allowed you to have that kind of more risk-taking mindset? Like, it is okay for me to leave behind everything I know and have here and almost set up again socially, economically and everything in a completely new place.
So I think at that time, I was not thinking this way. I was more thinking like, fuck it, I don't have any, you know, bright future happening here. Let's just get there. I have this opportunity to go somewhere else and I really liked it over there. Let's just go somewhere else. So I think it was more, as you said, subconsciously saying, okay, my parents did it, so I can do it as well. And I see people doing it as well, so why not, right? And I also had a couple of friends with whom I studied with back in Japan that I met in Japan as well. And they also managed to also get a job and work in Japan. Sam was one of them actually. And then for me as well, it was a motivation shit. Okay, they did it as well. Sam, you know, he's also French Algerian. My other friend is David and he's actually French Chinese. And they both, you know, fucked off as well and found a good job in Japan. So I was like, okay, screw it. Me too, you know, I want to be part of this group as well. And this is where I was like, okay, let's just do it.
And so, moving to Japan, you said obviously when you moved to your white neighborhood, you were quite different to a lot of the people. Moving to Japan, you are now definitely different to the local people there.
Yeah.
And also don't sound like them either. And then probably don't have similar tastes in possibly music, definitely food, these kind of things. So you're moving to a place where you're in fact more different. How would you compare how you were treated in terms of as being different to the majority of people around you?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, as you know, right, like Japan, big culture shock. And then for me as well, another culture shock was that most of my friends that left and, you know, worked in Japan, they usually find the route of like working for a French company there because there's some kind of like, you know, easy way to do that. But for me, I was kind of lucky in some way to actually go and start working for an American company. And then there was like a second cultural shock because it was, okay, American company, American mindset, but then with Japanese people.
Yeah.
And then I just started as an intern here. I speak a little bit of Japanese, but just like really conversational kind of Japanese. And I get sent into like a room with like full of Japanese people, my boss and my team, and they only speak Japanese, right? And then I'm in a meeting here, my first meeting, I'm like, what the hell? What am I doing here? What the hell is going on? And then I was like, fuck, actually I have a 6 month internship. Let's make the most of it. And then just like, whatever, shoot for the moon, right? And then I thought like, okay, let's do this. Like every day I was coming back home and I was studying my Japanese for like 1 to 2 hours every day so that I could reach kind of a level as though I could like, you know, work in Japanese. And then from there, 6 months down the line, my Japanese improved a lot and I could like kind of like get a, you know, Japanese language certification of a certain level that actually allows you to actually find a job in Japan. And then from them, you know, since, you know, I did well as well on the work side, then they offered me a job. But as you said, right, it was like just such a different world. And then a big cultural shock as well that I also had, you know, when I studied. But that being said, why I liked it, because and why my friends also liked it is because we felt like really free.
Mm.
And then over there, for once, this was the first time in my life where I would tell my Japanese colleagues or anyone else that, hey, I'm French. And then they would say like, oh, bonjour, or like, oh, I like wine, I like cheese, I like bread, and not like ask me, oh yeah, but like, you don't look French. Where are you from? What's your roots? What's your background? And as crazy as it is, because, you know, people have this image of Japan being like super racist, but this is the place where I actually felt the less discriminated against and felt the less racism in my whole life for the first time, right? Obviously, you know, as I lived there for like almost 8 years, then you find like, you know, some like bad sides as well. But at the beginning for us, it was like, fuck, like this is the first time I feel that I'm actually really French and for who I am, right? And I'm not like treated like a second class citizen or whatever. And I actually had to actually talk about like, oh, but by the way, I'm also, you know, Algerian from my parents, blah, blah, blah. And they wouldn't understand. Oh, of course they know, because, you know, they've seen the French national team and they've seen, you know, it's a diverse country. So they know that, you know, yeah, some things happening. And I think maybe also comes from the fact that, you know, Japanese people in general are a bit more shy and they don't ask or they don't want to hurt people. But for me, I was like, wow, okay, here I'm French, shit, like give me a beret, right? Let's go. So that was kind of like the feeling that I had. And that was like the good experience. But for me, the big step was really to learn Japanese.
Hmm.
And this really made me able to understand Japanese culture and things even more. And for them as well, you know, when you speak Japanese, it's just a different ballgame. They're just going to treat you totally differently as well. They'll
absolutely
explain a lot more to you. That being said, they're not as bad as in other countries, because even if you don't, then they'll be like super nice and polite and everything with you. But then when you speak with them in their language, then they'll be like even a lot more open, and you discover like, you know, some part of the you know, culture that you would never otherwise.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it reminds me of moving to China. So I obviously moved in 2018. By that point, expats, international people, that it was very open to that. And from a Chinese point of view, as a country, quite selfishly done, but smartly done. So they had a huge influx of expats. It was quite easy for people to come in, especially talented, skilled labor, because China realized that, you know, Western Europe, the developed markets, they were pushing ahead with innovation. China wanted to learn, and boy, do they learn quick.
Yeah. So
by the time I came in, you know, I'm brown skinned, but from the UK. My voice obviously gives that away, but I never felt any kind of, you know, someone's looking at me. Like you say, you know, there are definitely, the longer you live somewhere, you will come across experiences. But as a whole, I never felt that the color of my skin put me at any sort of disadvantage or frowned upon. But at the same time, something that I think is quite common in places like China, Japan, it is, we will let you in, but we'll only really be able to connect with you if there's something to connect with, right?
Exactly.
And so that comes to, if it's business, fine. You know, like, this is one thing I say about the Chinese, that they can come across as quite rude and selfish, but they're actually just genuine. They don't put on this fake face cover of like, hey, you know, we're best friends.
Mm.
Once there is that connection, so say if, you know, I've been to business dinners, business meetings, conversations where they obviously now have this reason to connect with you because it's over business, they're like the nicest people. They won't let you pay for anything. They'll feed and drink you until you can't move.
Yeah.
It's a very genuine approach to, I will befriend you once there's a reason to be friends with you.
Sure.
And I feel that what you're saying is, it was, I know the Japanese are considered a lot more polite and nice, but I think it sounds like they carry that same kind of culture and mindset behind them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I totally, right? I think it's definitely the case. And, you know, for me as well, I had some experience in China. I've traveled like quite a lot for work as well there. And that's, I mean, the kind of same feeling as well, you know, hospitality as well. They're very nice with you, even if you're foreigner or whatever. Obviously, my experience in Japan was longer, so I could know more. But like, also, I think, you know, at the end of the day, that's true. In terms of connecting with them, it's not going to be the same. And I don't know about China, because I didn't live there, even in Hong Kong, long enough to know. But in Japan as well, the concept of like that we have a friendship of like that we can have, you know, in the Western world is definitely not the same in Japan. And even if you think that you created some ties with someone, and you would consider him or her as a friend, then they'll be fine to just like, you know, see you or see you once a year or text you, you know, once every 3 months. Whereas for us, if you have friends, you'd be constantly in contact with them on group chats, or you'd be meeting them, you know, once in a while, or with your very good friends, it's going to be, you know, almost like every day or every week. Over there, you know, I would talk to some of my colleagues like, oh, yesterday I'm so happy because I saw my best friend. I was like, okay, why? Like, no, because I didn't see him like for 6 months and I was so happy and so chuffed. And I was like, okay, but that's your best friend. You could see him everywhere and he lives like, you know, not that far. And it's just that, you know, they have a different mindset when it comes to relationship and friendships, and which means that for us, we think that we don't integrate well in those societies, but it's just more that they don't connect into the same kind of level of friendship that we do. So it'll feel different, right? And the friends, the Japanese friends that we keep as of now, you know, with Shuo and all these guys, is mostly people that have a more foreign mindset because they lived, you know, abroad for a while. They lived in Europe, they lived in the US or whatever. And then they don't think the same way as, you know, local people.
Yeah. I want to put a wrapper around your Japan life in a nice layer. So tell me, number one of your best memories of your time in Japan, and secondly, your biggest or one of your biggest regrets.
I think, you know, there's a lot of good memories, obviously, but I think some of my best memories were where, you know, as you know, I lived there for like 8 years, and I've traveled a lot over there, and I've known a lot of people, I've made a lot of friends. But I think some of my best memories was actually, you know, since it was part of my life, you know, being in Japan, it was a new culture that I was acquiring there. It was being able to show that to my family. So my family came over 2 times, and my sister 3 times actually. And one of my best memories actually was on my last year, just before I moved to Hong Kong, we went to this big like music festival called Fuji Rock in the middle of like the mountains, like, you know, where people ski usually in winter. And it was a huge like music festival with like, you know, big artists were coming in, Kendrick Lamar and like Nerd and like Post Malone, and all these guys were here that year. And I was able to enjoy that with my sister, and then with Sam, and then Cham Cham was here too, and like, you know, a bunch of friends and even like some work colleagues that I really liked. And for me, it was just like, it was towards the end of my, you know, time in Japan. So I was like, fuck, I'm just experiencing the best of Japan and the best of the world at the same time. And it was just the best festival I've been in my life. So I think that's one of the best memories I have in Japan. That and maybe, you know, the food, because the food is just amazing and I love food. And food in Japan is just the best as well. And then the other thing was what, like the worst memory or the thing that I regret?
Yeah, I would say what was your... Actually, I'm actually going to change that second question because I don't like the word regret. So instead, what one thing would you have done differently with your time in Japan?
That I would have done differently with my time in Japan? Maybe I think it would have been, so at the beginning, I think for my first like whatever 5 or 6 years, I was like, you know, really into a small group of friends that I really love, that, you know, they're my best friends. You know, Sam is one of them and some other, you know, all over the world right now, but most of them in Japan as well. And then we kind of like went this dynamic where we were like just between us for like 5 years, and we're like, you know, doing our stuff, you know, working and going out and stuff together. Yeah. But we stayed like in this like kind of like small circle. And then as some of them kind of moved on, you know, moved out of Japan or whatever, then we started to kind of open up a little more. And this is where we kind of like stop, you know, what we met Shuo, we met Chan Chan and these guys. And from there, it was like the past, like whatever, 2 years before I left Japan. And I had like so much really good encounters, and, you know, I opened my mind even more. And I thought, okay, maybe, you know, I should have opened up like a little bit earlier on, you know, when I was in Japan.
I agree. And I think a lot of people will share that view, or, you know, at least I definitely do. Of even my time in China, there was that initial excitement rush of, you know, finding your core group of good friends, because especially when you move to a place where you don't know many people, when you do find those people that you really connect with, who in some ways may even be closer connections than your friends back home, because now you have that mindset of someone, like you say, who thinks internationally, then you do get caught up in that, like, we're in this new place, we're together and we explore, and then you sort of shut out some other bits of being able to connect with the locals or really experience some of the local bits. So I definitely went through the same thing, so I can relate. And it took a while of being like, okay, I have to realize I'm in this completely new place that some people will never even get the chance to visit. I need to make the most of some of the surroundings that I haven't been to begin with. Yeah, so what came next? What came next after your time there?
So after that, you know, it was really a move within my company. They just like decided to kind of like move the headquarters, the Asia headquarters from Japan to Hong Kong. And they wanted me to kind of like go there with them because I was kind of getting closer to the like senior guys there. I was planning to actually go back to Europe at that time. It was back, you know, end of 2017, 2018. And I was planning to go back to Europe already. And then now they want me to kind of go to Hong Kong. And I'm not the biggest fan of Hong Kong. I know it's nice, but especially at that point in life where I was, you know, like early 30s or whatever. If I was 20, then sure, yeah, you know, let's go. Hong Kong is an amazing place, you know, you're going to really enjoy. But like, you know, when you're in your early 30s and you kind of like, you know, want to settle down or whatever, then Hong Kong might not be the best place. But I say yes because it was, you know, I was still like doing well in that company. I still wanted to learn a little bit. So I was like, okay. And I knew that it was kind of like, okay, I'm going to put another year in this company and then just like get ahead of it because it was just like too much pressure, too much work. And Hong Kong, not the best, you know, country that I wanted to go and live in. So let's just like, you know, make the most of this year in Hong Kong, learn a lot and then get the fuck out of here, which is pretty much what I've done. I've stayed like about a year there. And it was like, you know, in January, February of 2020, where I was like, okay, I'm just going to put my, you know, resignation in and I'm going to go travel the world for a bit, you know, for 4 to 6 months. And then I'm just going to try and relocate in Europe. Obviously, it was the worst timing to kind of like decide to do that because, you know, March 2020 was where, you know, COVID really hit, like the shit hits the fan, you know, all over the world. Because at the beginning, I was part of as the world thought, okay, this fucking thing is just a China problem. It's an Asia problem at most, and that's fine. But no one really knew that it was going to be a global pandemic, right? And then for me, I was like, fuck, if, you know, I'd rather go and travel and then go back to Europe, you know, as soon as I can. So let's get the hell out of here. And this didn't happen, obviously, because, you know, the world kind of shut down and I had to stay a little bit more in Hong Kong. And then, you know, next thing you know, I just, you know, find my girlfriend there and then we just like, you know, decide to do plans together. And, you know, this was kind of unexpected. So in hindsight, I'm like, okay, then I'm glad that I kind of like decided to go to Hong Kong. So that was a good experience as well.
It's funny because I think you said when you met your girlfriend, then you decided to do plans together. But I heard it as do planks together. And I just imagine you two holding a plank for like the longest time that you can and being like, yeah, we just decided that we're just going to do planks.
Yeah. It was just, I wouldn't say planks, but my accent got the best of me here. And we're also doing planks together, actually, when we work
there
together in the morning.
You know, if anyone needs relationship advice on how to make a relationship succeed in work, just do planks together.
Exactly.
Or conquer all. It's interesting. So obviously, you know, you were talking about how you made a plan and then obviously COVID came in and completely radically shifted that. Do you think the experiences that you've been through probably since, you know, a very young age of growing up in a certain environment, moving to a place where you're surrounded by people who are different, do you think going through these experiences where you've been through these changes and new forms of integration and having to figure stuff out along the way, that when this happened where you had a plan and it kind of got shifted because of the pandemic, that you were able to navigate and deal with that better because of your past experiences?
I think, yeah, that's definitely fair. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm still in that phase of like dealing through it because I still, you know, need to kind of like find a job and still then, you know, where I want to be. But that's definitely the case, right? I mean, growing up, you know, in my family, you know, having those like two different cultures and stuff and traveling around as well, you know, as part of my work and knowing different cultures as well made me like, you know, very adaptable. And I think, you know, that was kind of like one of my quality, I guess, before as well. But the fact of like going through those different places and having to start anew and stuff really helped me do so. And I think that's why I'm not like, obviously there's risks in every kind of decision that you make. But at the end of the day, if you've already been through it before and you know somehow how it works, then you know, it's kind of easier to get there. So that mindset definitely, you know, helped me.
That's amazing. And, you know, I connected with you, I think it was during that lockdown phase, right? So for me, it's so interesting and valuable to know the Sadie I knew from when I connected with you in the middle of this lockdown to now get that rich history to figure out why you are as I viewed you, right? Which is a guy who's got a lot of experience, but also a lot of understanding and ambition. So really the final question is the stage that you're at now, What is that vision going forward?
I mean, hey, at the end of the day, you know, I think, you know, I'm very grateful to all the experiences that I had, and especially I think that's something, you know, to say out there. Some of your guests before said it as well. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to travel, you have to experience other cultures and other kind of like settings to kind of like open your mind. And I think for me, you know, being in Japan and, you know, travel for work or and meeting people from all walks of life as well, really helped me to kind of like be more open-minded into like any kind of things, right? Before, you know, when you're born and raised in a certain country, or even when you pack on a certain culture, and French, you know, has a really strong culture in a way, or strong opinions about everything, right? So it's very hard when you go out of there and like, hey, this is how people think, this is how things are done, to kind of like question that and be like, oh shit, actually, you know, that's not the way it's done everywhere else, right? So for me, what I've done, you know, when I was in Japan and working for an American company, is that I've kind of like taken bits of culture here and there and just like took the best thing out of each culture and tried to implement it in my life. And I think it worked out well as well, because, you know, when I came to Japan, I was like, not that, you know, organized or whatever. And then, you know, you come to Japan, everything is on point, everything works. And that kind of developed that side of me of being like, okay, let's be more, you know, reliable, on point or whatever. And then, you know, working from some American company as well, you know, investment fund or whatever, that also helped me to kind of like be more adaptable, being okay to embrace change as well, because that's something that doesn't really happen much in France or in Japan as well. And that thing, I think, you know, I just like, that's what for me, I thought, okay, now I can come back, you know, to Europe, because I want to kind of like be close to my family as well. And I can, you know, build from there and like, you know, settle then as well. And like, you know, try to put into my life what I experienced, you know, abroad as well, and still, you know, being open-minded to kind of like learn new cultures as well. But, you know, the other thing as well is that, you know, I work in some kind of industry that where I don't really share the values anymore, you know. So in terms of like, oh, I mean, I really never share the kind of value of like, you know, being super whatever aggressive, speculative, you know, capitalistic kind of thing. And I think now the world also is kind of on the cusp of like going through a big change in terms of like, you know, sustainable development. And, you know, that's going to be really the next, you know, decade is going to be the decade of like, you know, clean energy, clean everything. Before it was tech, and now it's going to be that, because we just have no choice, right? And for me, that's why now I'm doing that as well. I'm trying to see, okay, what's my angle? How can I kind of like change the expense that I had before, which was like, you know, more standard kind of like finance, to something that could actually, you know, be helpful. And I really, you know, I really believe in it as well. So that's why I thought like, okay, maybe now taking the time off with this whole pandemic, you know, time to reflect, time to kind of like do new things. And I'm just going to go and try to do, to go in that direction. Obviously, if it doesn't come right now, maybe I'll, you know, still work in the same kind of environment for a few years, but I'm already working on that side, so that, okay, the next actually big risk is that. And it's also at the same time a big opportunity. Like the more I read about it, the more I'm actually studying about it right now to get some kind of certificate. And more, I'm like, shit, actually, the opportunities are really endless. And this is what people don't see, because they're just used to the way they think, right? And that, and to the way the world worked before. And but now it's picking up, and it's picking up really fast. So I thought, okay, maybe then it's time for me to jump on that wagon when it's not yet mainstream, but it's like getting there, right? So I think that's the kind of like that's the kind of view I have, you know, for the next, you know, a few years for myself.
Yeah, it's amazing what you said there, and it's something that I can really relate to in two ways. Firstly, it's the idea of once you've grown up in different environments and moved abroad in different environments, I do notice that you kind of start to have an appreciation for the world as a whole, right? So when you've grown up in one place, and maybe you can relate, you know, some of the people you know back home, all they really know is that bubble that they're in.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because a lot of them are content. But then once you've started seeing other parts of the world where you've seen poverty, you've seen extreme richness, you've seen nature, then you start to appreciate these kind of things of, okay, how much can I align my kind of passions and actions and money-making ambitions with at least doing something that is making the world a better place in whatever capacity I can do, right? So you're talking about looking at like sustainable and these other forms of cleaner energy, etc. you know, for me, I feel that part of your experiences and what you've been through plays into why you have that kind of mindset of thinking beyond just the maybe what is the most cost-effective, efficient way of doing things now, which may not be as beneficial for the future.
Definitely.
And just the second bit to that is also that, going back to kind of what we discussed before, you had a plan, it got changed by the pandemic, now you're kind of repositioning, but you also know within you, you have that ability to take risks and adapt and try new things because you see the opportunity in it. Yeah. Instead of just fearing like, oh no, I don't know what's around the corner. It's an unknown. I'm scared to step into that.
Yeah.
Let me just try and find my comfort zone in my bubble. So it's just two things you said in that, which is why I think we really connected in, which is why I really wanted to have you on as a guest, because
Thanks. It's
these kind of mindsets that I think comes with some element of coming from a third culture background, but also just that, as you described it, that international mindset.
No, definitely. I mean, hey, at the end of the day, the bigger kind of like risk that I took, they are the one who paid off, right? Me moving to Japan, having this kind of new career. And then even when I did my first change of job, going into this kind of like more challenging kind of job, it was like the first 6 months, I didn't think I could make it, but then I stayed like for almost 4 years and a half and learned a lot. And also that helped me, okay, be kind of like financially stable in a way that now I can actually afford to be, you know, like spending a few months here and kind of like reposition that. So it's always like, okay, you've taken like small risks that paid off and you made small bets that are paying off. Obviously some of them don't, but some of them will, and big time. That's how you have to capitalize on that, right? So that's, you know, exactly how you wrap this up was perfect, yeah.
Good luck, man. And I'm obviously going to be following you every step of the way. We have our monthly masterminds, which are great. And yeah, I recommend that to anyone listening, that find a group of people that you connect with and hold each other accountable. I'm not saying anything new. You know, this has been preached for years. But, you know, as someone who's doing it, I really see the value in it. So
there is yeah.
Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. And yeah, so just to finish now, as I do with all the guests, I do what's called the quick fire final five. I will ask you five questions and, you know, the quicker you answer them, the better. But you can obviously go into detail if you want.
Yep, let's do it.
So if you are happy with that, then we will kick off with those questions.
Sure, let's go.
Question number one. Drum roll, please. What is the worst advice that you've ever received?
I think some of the worst advice I've received was really to kind of like stay where you are, don't move, don't take that risk. I think that's the kind of advice that, you know, some people would give me. And then I'm glad I didn't follow that, because most of my life then was like, you know, about kind of like being able to travel and do new things and meet new people and learn about new cultures. So
yes, it's so true. And it kind of goes back to that point, right, of some people who've always remained in their bubble.
Yeah,
because they find contentment in it. It's kind of, you know, they fail to understand stepping outside of that and maybe going against that norm of, you know, get a job and then get married and then settle down and have a kid, right?
Exactly.
Anything outside that
was my plan at the beginning, but then, you know, I'm glad I didn't take that route. And I still, you know, I kind of sometimes, you know, have trouble to connect with my friends who did that and who still don't understand what I've, you know, what I've been doing for the past 10 years. But hey, that's life.
Yeah, that is well said. And question number two, how would you describe life in Japan in three words?
Okay, well, that's a tough one. Amazing, surprising, and full. Honestly, it was full for me for, you know, the ages I've spent over there.
Yeah, I like that. I like the, it's full. It's such a small word, but with such depth to it. That's good.
Yeah.
Question three. What one lesson would you want to give to the current or future leaders of Africa?
Okay. Well, hey, that's a good one. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, unfortunately, it really depends on what your passport is, but I mean, it's going to be the same thing, right? It's like, you know, just travel, just meet people, just open up your mind to other cultures. But then, you know, even if you can't, then it's just going to be, you know, learn, right? I think now we in this day and age where you don't have to like have to go in the best university to learn, you know, something to make of your life. You can pretty much, you know, acquire skills online by, you know, doing online courses or whatever, or everything's pretty much there, which is like an access to information that's, you know, never been able to reach before, right? So I think, you know, the best thing for me is like, you know, if you can, then, you know, travel and have an experience somewhere else, a meaningful one, not just like traveling for a few months, but like for a few years, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, get the best of every culture that you know encounter and try to, you know, implement that in your life, basically.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot.
And also, and especially because you said from Africa, and I would say for that as well, it's just like, you know, don't be scared, because the problem is that for people that come from this background, it's usually, you know, even if you think that, you know, you can be the equal of everyone, there's always a subconscious way, because you always reminded that you're inferior, that you just don't dare because you think that you're inferior to anyone else. But I would say, like, you know, be fearless and just, you know, do things, act.
Boom, that is strong. Study for president. I like that. Question 4, and this is, you know, the second part of your presidential campaign. As the world becomes more globalized, do you think this will make us more or less happy as a population?
Honestly, hey, the French in me in world would have said no, because, you know, we're inherently pessimistic. But now that, like, I'm a different person, I would say definitely yes. And I think, you know, because it played out well for my personal experience as well, and now that I know, is that the more globalized we get, then the better it is. And obviously, you know, holding to your own culture is important, but being open to other cultures is actually more important. It's wherever I've seen, you know, people being kind of like in contact with other cultures, with other kind of like backgrounds, then this is where all the prejudices kind of like come down and falls down, and, you know, people are not racist anymore. So it's all about, you know, actually being able to mix people together.
Yeah, I love that. It just reminds me of a study done, or some kind of experiment, where when there was more mixing of West Indians with the Caribbeans and everyone in that geographical region, there was a significant reduction in social tensions between the different groups.
Yeah.
And I know that's something they're trying to do in Africa as well. So, like, my parents being from East Africa, and I think also it's happening in South Africa, where they're trying to make less of a taboo between, you know, cross-cultural marriages and relationships. Yeah. In order to break down that sort of social pressure between the two groups. So yeah, I love that. That's a good point. Very good point.
No, definitely. I mean, and I've seen that, and I think some cultures have understood that like a lot earlier than others. And I would say, you know, because I worked a lot for like American companies that see, okay, they put diversity on the pedestal, but it's also true and it happens over there and it somehow works. And it's still not the case in the old continent, but it's getting there, hopefully.
Yeah, good point. Question 5, what would you want to be written on your gravestone?
Okay, that's an interesting one. He was useful to the world. I want to still kind of like live with like a positive impact.
Yeah, I love that. And finally, the bonus question: how would you describe your third culture upbringing in a 6-word sentence?
Very straightforward upbringing, but also generous. I mean, the generosity that I had in my family and my upbringing was like something that also defined me as who I am. But also the fact that, you know, in my kind of like culture, people from Algeria, people are sometimes really straightforward and can be hurtful for a lot of people, but it's also a good way to kind of like, you know, say things and get things done. So I'm trying to become some kind of in between now.
I like that. So straightforward upbringing, but also generous. Beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, that's as good as it gets. I mean, hey.
No, it's good. And what I think is such a nice sort of way to end on, it kind of shows an appreciation for your upbringing, but your parents and your culture as a whole. So
yep.
Love that we've ended off on that note. Amazing. Thank you for everything you've shared.
Hey, we can still talk about it, you know, next time in London. Let's just, you know, have a drink and we can debate on that a lot more. I have a lot more stuff to share, and I want to hear more also about you.
And a big thanks to you for listening in. I hope that this was as eye-opening for you as it was for me. Let's not forget, my aim of the show is to spotlight the lives and experiences of the guests so that you can see whether you can relate to and apply some of their lessons and perspectives to your own situation. If you are able to connect with something that was discussed, share this episode with someone who can resonate or possibly has a similar story to share. Tag them on Instagram. You can find the podcast page by searching The Journey Onwards Podcast or by following the link in the description. People ask me what my end goal is for the podcast. Along with connecting deeper with all the interesting people in my own life, I'm also building out a platform where each of you can showcase your experience and passions from the lens of being third culture individuals and share this to an audience. If you're interested to be a part of this growing network, then head over to podcast.thejourneyonwards.com/tribe, leave me your email address and I will be in touch with the details. As always, I am super grateful for the feedback that you sent to me, as well as your reviews on Apple Podcasts, which I notice are going up, so I cannot thank you enough. I'll be back next week for another episode, so until then, I hope your next week is even better than the last.